Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, David, the King of Israel. This is 2 Samuel 5, along with 1 Chronicles 11, 12, and 14. Last week, I ended with David becoming the king of all of Israel. But this week, we're going to back up just a little bit because in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, it tells us kind of how he came to be this, how the people started following him. And so if you remember, the people are first introduced to David when he fights Goliath. And then after that, David begins to fight for Israel. And the people fall in love with him. They even say, you know, Saul killed thousands, but David's killing 10,000s. You know, he is a great warrior. And that says that they loved him because he went in and out amongst them. So he was a people person. You know, he wasn't just sitting up in the palace or being a commander that just, you know, tells people what to do and moves on. He was interacting with the people, and they loved him for that. But then Saul got jealous and eventually openly turned against David. And once it became open that Saul was done with him and he was trying to kill him, the people had a choice to make. And many people chose to leave the king and even their country to follow David whenever he went to take refuge in the land of the Philistines. It tells us that 600 men were with him at that time. And chapter 12 kind of goes through some of those men, gives us a little bit of an idea of who was following him at that time when he was living in the land of the Philistines in the town of Ziklag, and how it progresses to this point where everyone is coming together to make him the king. And so in chapter 12 of 1 Chronicles, it says that some of the men that came to follow him were even from the tribe of Benjamin, which is Saul's home tribe. And so that lets you know right there that, you know, they believe in David enough to not only leave their country, but leave the man that's leading their tribe, representing their tribe on behalf of the nation of Israel, and go to follow David. And it says that these men could fight with both their left and right hands. They could shoot bows with both their right and left hands, and they could sling stones with both hands. And this is kind of a play on words because Benjamin's name means son of my right hand. And so they're also saying, you know, these men had been Saul's right-hand men, and now they've switched sides and they are fighting for the opposition. And so it's just a little bit of a play on words, letting us know that it's significant that these people would switch sides, or like a person who can fight with their right or their left, go back and forth. These people have left their right hand and gone to the left. And so these are the first people that it mentions, and it tells us a couple of the people's names. We're not going to go through those names. Some of these people are significant that we already know, and we'll talk about them. And some of them will become significant later on. And when they do, we will address that they were part of this group. But right now, we're not going to go through the names because most of them don't mean anything to us. But it does list the two brothers that are his top guys there, and then two other sets of brothers, and 17 more men that are from the tribe of Benjamin that have come over to support him. And then it goes through the Gadites, and it says that the people of Gad crossed over the Jordan River whenever it was the rainy season and the banks of the river were overflowing because they believed in David so much. And it lists some of those people and tells us that they were made officers of his army because they were so skilled in shields and spears. And it says that they were also very strong and fast. It said they had the face of a lion and were swift as gazelles. And so 11 of these men were specifically mentioned. And it says that when the people of Benjamin and even Judah, his own tribe, came to him in Ziklag, he was like, okay, are you guys here to help or hurt me? You know, because if you're here to help, I would love that and I will accept your friendship. But if you are here to turn me over to Saul, then I'm going to turn you over to God and let him take care of you. And they were like, oh no, we're here to support you. We wish you only peace. And he said, okay, come on and join us. And then we hear a part of the story that happened back when David went with the king of Gath to the Jezreel Valley to fight the Israelites. We find out here that the tribe of Manasseh, some of the people from that tribe went back to Ziklag with David at that time. So the king of Gath had brought them over to fight the Israelites, but the rest of the Philistines did not trust him. And so they said, we want you to go back to Ziklag. And at that time, some of the people from the tribe of Manasseh decided to go back with him. And when he got to Ziklag and found out that the women and children had been captured, these people went along with him to get those people back. And so we find out a little bit of the people that came to support him were Judah, Benjamin, Gad, and Manasseh. That's just some of the people. And these must have been significant men in those tribes for their names to be mentioned. And then that chapter ends by saying all of those people have been supporting David all up to this point. And now, whenever he is in Hebron, Saul and all of his sons have died. Now, tens of thousands of people come to Hebron to make him their king. And it lists each tribe and says, this many thousand men came from this tribe. Tens of thousands of men came from this tribe. All of them decorated in their battle armor, ready and prepared to fight to make him king or just show their support. So these are all representatives of each tribe coming to make David their king. And that's what we talked about last week, how everyone gathered in Hebron to make him their king. But we find out here that there are tens of thousands of people that have come to make him their king, each representatives of their own nation, of their own tribe, and that some of the people who didn't come sent food and they stayed there for 3 days celebrating and eating this food that had been sent by the other people. And so this is just something that we didn't talk about last week that just tells us how many people had been following David all the way up to this point, right? Before he ever became the king of Israel, the people had been gathering around him increasingly. And so that ends 1 Chronicles chapter 12. And 1 Chronicles 11 is a little backtracking, and it goes through 2 Samuel 5. And this chapter begins by telling us that David's first act as king was to find a neutral place to rule. Because remember, he's been ruling in Hebron, but that was only over the people of Judah, and that's his home tribe. And so he doesn't want to stay there because it would look as if he's really only ruling over his own people. And now that he's ruling over the entire nation, he needs a neutral place that represents everyone. And Jerusalem was that perfect spot, according to David, because it really wasn't owned by anyone. It was on the boundary of both Judah and Benjamin, which was another reason that it was a perfect spot, because this is the tribe of both of the kings, the two warring houses, the two warring tribes for the kingdom. And so for it to be right there on their border, a town shared by both of them, means a good compromise. Means that David is showing that I'm not going to stay there in Judah. I'll make the capital city, the ruling city, both of our cities. And so I'm accepting the tribe of Benjamin, regardless of the fact that, you know, y'all have been warring with me, maybe specifically because Saul was of your tribe. And then this city was not owned by anyone because the Jebusites had been living there ever since the Israelites invaded the land and took it over. And they've never been actually able to drive the Jebusites out of that area. And so they had just allowed them to live there. And so David's like, God told us to eradicate all of the existing people from the land. We never did that. And so I'm going to go in and I'm going to take Jerusalem from these people like we should have done in the first place. And then I'm going to make this the capital city. Now, I do need to say that one of the reasons that they never did take this city is because it has kind of a natural wall built around it, because it's up on a hill and it has steep cliffs on three sides. And so it's difficult already to penetrate. And then there has been a retaining wall built around this city. And so it seems impenetrable. And they haven't been able to do anything about it yet. And the Jebusites feel like they're in good hands up there and don't have to worry about the Israelites. And so I want to read to you specifically what the Jebusites said and how David defeated this city and what he said, because it's kind of funny and I can't quite do it justice by just telling you the story. And so we're going to begin reading in 2 Samuel 5, verse 6, and it says, "The king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, and the inhabitants of the land who spoke to David, saying, 'You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you,' thinking that David couldn't come in." So what they're saying is that this city is so easy to defend. It could be defended by a lame and a blind man. Like, you're not getting in here. We don't even have to bring our best warriors, right? And it says in verse 7, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion," that is the city of David. So we'll talk about that later, why it was called Zion and what the significance is of Zion. But it says that he did take the city. And then in verse 8, it says, "David said on this day, 'Whoever climbs up by the way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain.' Therefore, they say, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.'" So what he's saying here is that anyone that can take this city will be taking it from the people that they say are lame and blind, you know. And in 1 Chronicles 11, we find out that Joab is the one that takes this city, which, you know, we've heard about already. He is already his chief commander. But in 1 Chronicles 11, it says that whoever's able to take it will be his commander. And so Joab secures his spot as David's commander by being the first one to go in. And David even tells him how to go in. He says, "You need to go in through the water shafts." Well, we have since excavated this area and found out that they had an extensive tunnel network that got water from the Gihon Spring and brought it to the town of Israel, because it's up on a mountain and there's no other way to get the water. And so this shaft, what they believe is this shaft that Joab and the troops went through, was 230-foot shaft. And they go through this area and, you know, they're saying that only that even the blind and the lame can defeat them, defend this area. And so David says, "Well, go take it from the lame and the blind." And You know, they are kind of blind to the fact that they're about to get invaded. They do not believe that, and they're crippled in their defense. And so these are the lame and the blind, and that's why they said it became a saying that the lame and the blind are no longer welcome in this house. So meaning the Jebusites. So it's just kind of funny the way that they word all of this. And it says, then David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Milo inward. So the Milo was the retaining wall and then the supporting walls behind it. And he built terraces to level all of this land out. So they're able to build the city by making everything level. And so David begins to build the city. In 1 Chronicles 11, we find out that Joab takes care of the rest of the city. David builds the part that he calls the city of David, so his area. And then Joab builds the rest of the area. So this is a place where they can operate as a ruling party there from this spot. And then at some point, we're not exactly sure at what point, this is kind of a summary of what happened in Jerusalem, beginning in verse 11. At some point, Jerusalem and David and the nation of Israel began to get noticed by other nations. They began to want to trade with them. They began to want to make alliances with them. And so in chapter 5, verse 11, it says that Haran, the king of Tyre, which is on the Mediterranean coast, a trade city, a port city, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons to build his house. So this would be a big deal because most of the houses at that time were built only of stone. And so for him to have a house with wood on it and carpenters working on it, it would have been very special. It would have been a beautiful home. And the king was willing to help make his home beautiful, you know, as a gesture of goodwill so that maybe David would trade with him and they would have a good relationship. And then it goes on to say that David, he made alliances with other nations by taking more concubines and more wives. Remember that he had already done this, we talked about last week, with one extra woman while he was living in Hebron, who was the daughter of the king in Syria, because he was trying to make an alliance with him so that he wouldn't side with Ishbosheth, who was directly to his south. It's like it made perfect sense that he would side with Ishbosheth, providing the proximity. And so David married his daughter so that maybe if there was a battle with him and Saul's house, he would side with him. And so this was very common back in those days where they would begin to marry women from other nations to make alliances with them. Because the thought is, if you are, you know, you're married to someone from this other country, then you're not going to act in bad faith towards that country. You'll have their interest at heart. She always has the king's ear. And so lots of kings did this. This was very common practice, but God forbid any of the Israelite kings from doing this when he set aside all of the rules for the future kings of Israel before there was ever a king. He said, I don't want y'all to do that, because if you do, then because you have their country's interest at heart, they may persuade you to turn away from the ways that I tell you to do things and begin to do things in their way, and that'll pull you away from me. So I don't want you to do that. But David did not listen to that command, and so it tells us that he married many more wives and got more concubines, and then they had more children. Now, in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, in the very first verse, it tells us that David built houses in the city of David. So not just his house, but many houses. And this is not buildings. And so another thing that was common practice back then is if you did have multiple wives, each of them had their own house to live in with their own children. And so presumably when David was building this city, the city of David, it was for him and all of his wives and children to live in, along with buildings for probably his officers and things like that. And so then in verse 17 of 2 Samuel 5, it begins to tell us a little bit about the Philistines. When they found out that the guy who used to live in their land, who they thought had defected from Israel, was now the king of Israel. Imagine their surprise and anger. And so it says that they came out to search for David and presumably do him harm. And when David finds out about this, he goes to God and he says, hey, the Philistines are in the valley of the Rephaim, and I need to know, do you want me to go out against them? And if so, will you give them into my hand? And God says, I will certainly give them into your hand. Go. And so David goes out, meets them, defeats them. They flee and leave their idols behind. And it says that David took those idols and burned them. So he has no respect for them or their gods. He never had defected to them. He was using them. And then it tells us that a little time later, they come back out to the Valley of the Rephaim. We don't have any idea how long this is. And David asks God again, do I go out against them? And God says, no, don't go out, you know, outwardly against them like you did last time. Instead, this time, I want you to go down behind them and hide within the trees. And whenever they get close, their marching will shake the trees and you'll know they're close enough for you to then come out and attack. So David said, okay, I'll do that. And he hid amongst the mulberry trees. And when they began to shake, he went out and defeated them. And after this story in 1 Chronicles 11, it tells us about more of David's mighty men. And we're going to go through those in a little bit more detail. And the reason is because I want you to see that, you know, from, like I said, the time that Saul turned against David, all the way up until the time that they made him the king, there were people gathering support for him. He was increasingly getting support from the people. And then after he became the king, he had several right-hand men that he trusted. And that is going to be the people here. And you just need to see how much the people trusted David and wanted to follow him. And so the chapter 23 begins by saying that he had three men besides Joab. We know that Joab was his very top chief commander. But after him, he had three men that stood out amongst all the rest. And it lists their names and says the reason that they stood out amongst everyone else is because in three separate fights with the Philistines, they single-handedly warded them off, because the rest of the Israelites ran away. And so they stood there and defended the land, one of them saying he swung until his hand was so tired he couldn't swing his sword anymore. And the people only came back after everyone was dead. And so these three men stand out amongst all the rest because they were willing to stay and fight unto the death or victory, when no one else was going to do that. And then it goes on to tell us that there was another man that was very significant, just not quite as good as those three. And this was Abishai. This is Joab's brother. And remember, he's the one who was in the cave whenever Saul came into the cave with David and his men. And Abishai said, God's given him into your hand. You should go and take him. And David was like, no, I'm not going to do that. God anointed him as king. I don't think that's why he's here. He's here for me to spare his life. And so that's what David did. This is that man. And it says that Abishai killed 300 men by himself. And so God made him the commander over the other 30 guys that he's about to list. So these are the 30 right-hand men that Abishai is commander over. And then the other guy that wasn't as good as the three, but was significant and ended up being made David's, the head of his personal guard, was Benaiah. And this man, it says, did many heroic deeds. He struck down two heroes of Moab. He killed a lion and he killed an Egyptian that was 7.5 feet tall with his own spear. He literally yanked the spear from the man's hand and killed him with it. So this is a very heroic guy. And David's like, I need you protecting me and I want you to be in charge of all those that protect me. And then it lists the 30 guys. The only problem is that it lists 32 men. And so it's like, why do you call them the 30 if there are 32? Well, one thing that we know is that Asahel, which was the third brother of Joab and Abishai, he was killed, remember, by Abner. And so he was one of the 30, but he died. There's another man who we'll find out about later, also listed among these, that died. And so most likely there were 30 men, but two of them died and were replaced with two more. And so that is why there's 32 names. Two of those men are dead. And so there's always 30 men. But then we have another problem. In 1 Chronicles 11, when it lists the men, it adds 15 more names. And so it's like, okay, what's going on here? Why does it call them the 30 if there are more names than 30? Well, it could be two things. It could be that 15 other men died by the time that they listed the people in 1 Chronicles 11, because the Chronicles are just chronicling what has happened. And so presumably this book is written at one time and the Chronicles is written at a later time. And so they've added 15 names because 15 men extra have died since they wrote 2 Samuel. And so they had to get 15 extra men. That'd be what I tend to believe. But the other thought is that they were just called the 30 at the time that they were 30 men, and it just sort of became their name. And then as time went on, he saw more men that were worthy of being in that tight-knit circle, and so he named them. Regardless of why it is, we know that these men that are named here are the most significant people to David, and they're named because of their value to him. And so, like I said, these names don't quite mean anything to us, but they mean a lot to the people that he's writing to at the time, and some of the people will become more important as we go along. But there was one little part that I didn't tell you about that's kind of right in the center of this chapter in chapter 23 of 2 Samuel, and it tells us about three of the 30 men. They don't tell us their names, but that did something so, so special for David, and it just gives us a glimpse as to what the people were willing to do for him. And it says that there was a time when David was hiding in the cave of Adullam, and the Philistines had come out, and they were encamped at Bethlehem. And it reminded David of his hometown of Bethlehem. And he just remarked, oh, I wish I could have a drink of water from the well that's at the gate of Bethlehem. You know, this is where I grew up and I love the water that comes from that well. And these three men just heard this. This is obviously not a command. It's nothing that David is asking anyone to do. He's kind of just exclaiming, you know, oh, I love the water from Bethlehem, being reminded of the fact that, you know, he used to live there. And it says that they broke through the enemy's camp just to get water for David. And then when they brought it to him, David is so overwhelmed by their selfless act that he's like, I can't take this water. I can't do this selfish thing by fulfilling my own desires. These men risked their lives just to give me this water. And so it says that they pour it out as a drink offering to the Lord. And so they were willing to sacrifice their lives, and David is willing to sacrifice his desire, and he pours it out as a drink offering to God, because the wine would sometimes be poured out as a drink offering to God, representing blood, the blood that was spilled for this sacrifice. And so he's saying these men were willing to shed their blood just to get me a drink of water from my hometown. And so I am going to pour this out as a drink offering to you as if it was their blood, because they could have been killed just to get me this drink of water. And so this just shows the great lengths that people were willing to go to for David. And if you've ever had a leader like this, that you'll just absolutely do anything for. It doesn't matter what they ask you to do. You're like, I'll do it because I trust them. I love them. I care about them. I believe in everything that they're trying to do, and I'll follow them anywhere. And it just shows you this is the type of person that David was. And that's why the people made him their king. They did say that they made him their king because they knew God had anointed him to be their king. But also they said, you're the one that led us even when Saul was the king. And they've always wanted to follow him. Even before he had any authority over them, they chose David, risking their lives, leaving their country, and even risking their lives just to give him a little taste of home. And so the first lesson that I think we can learn from this is, man, I want to be that kind of person, right? The kind of person that other people choose. You know, the first time that I have to start forcing another adult to do something that I want them to do, I should probably think, is my argument not persuasive enough? Am I not a person that they think enough of to just do this because I asked them, because they trust me and they believe in me? Maybe I need to change my tactics. You know, if I'm having to force or manipulate or coerce, then maybe I'm not doing something right, because I should be able to persuade people that are around me to do things if I am a competent leader, if I am someone worth following, if I am, you know, kind to them and they believe in what I'm doing. And so that's the first lesson that I think we can learn. And then the last thing that I want us to talk about today is Jerusalem. You know, we talked about why David chose Jerusalem, but why did God choose Jerusalem? Because God told the people in Deuteronomy 12 through Moses, he said, hey, I am going to choose a place to put my name when you get into this land. And this is the place that I want you to put my tabernacle and do all my sacrifices and all of those things. And this is the place. God chose Jerusalem. And so why did he do that? Well, this is the town that Abraham called Salem, which means the city of peace, derived from the word shalom. And this is where, when Abraham went to rescue his nephew Lot, when he got caught up in the battle between the five kings and the four kings, he saw the priest king of Salem, and he offered him a tenth of the spoils. And then this priest blessed him. And so this was the city of peace. Makes sense that God would choose it for that. And Jesus is compared to Melchizedek, the priest king, and we'll talk about that a little bit further in a minute, but this is why he chose the city. And then remember, I told you that I would tell you about the stronghold of Zion. Zion was Mount Moriah to Abraham. And this is the place where Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son. And it's also the place that Jesus sacrificed himself for us. And so it would be very fitting, right, that whenever the tabernacle comes to this place, that all of the sacrifices would be made in the town that Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son. It is also fitting that Jesus would sacrifice himself at the same place that Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son. God gave his son in the same place that Abraham gave his. The only difference is God gave Abraham a replacement for his son. Abraham didn't actually have to sacrifice his son, but there was no replacement for Jesus. Jesus was our replacement. He took our sins upon himself and became our replacement so that peace could be made between us and God. And so I'm going to read you a couple of verses about that. The first one is in Isaiah 53, 5 and 6. And it says, "But he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." So Jesus was our replacement. Then 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "He made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him." So he switched places with us. He took our sin and we took his righteousness. He's our replacement. This is substitutionary atonement. If you ever hear that word, that's what this means. He was our substitute. 1 Peter 2, 24-25 says, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness." So he died for us so that we could live for him. "By his wounds we have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." This is who Jesus is. This is what made Jesus our priest king, like Melchizedek. And in Hebrews chapter 7, if you would like to go and read that whole chapter, I'm not going to read it because it's too long, but it tells us why Jesus is compared to Melchizedek. But Hebrews chapter 10 also tells us why he is our priest and our king. And it is because he offered the sacrifice for us. That's what the priests do, right? He offered himself as a sacrifice for us. And then after he died, he arose and then ascended to sit at the right hand of the Father. And that is what makes him our king. He's ruling us from there. And so I'm going to read you Hebrews 10, beginning in verse 10, and it says, "By this will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all time. Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices, which can never take away our sins. But he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies are made a footstool at his feet." So what this is saying is these priests continually had to offer sacrifices because the animals just weren't sufficient enough to last for any length of time for our sins. They were just a picture of what really needed to happen. But Jesus made his offering one time, never has to do it again, and that's the reason he can go and sit on the throne now. He's done his job. He made that one offering, and that's it. That's all he has to do. And now that he's sitting at the right hand of the Father, he reigns over us in heaven. And it goes on in verse 14 to say, "For by one offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. And the Holy Spirit also testifies for us, saying, 'This is the covenant which I will make with them after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws upon their hearts, and I will write them in their mind, and I will remember their lawless deeds no longer.'" So he's saying, I don't come from the Levitical line, which is what Moses was from, who gave the law, because I'm going to write their law, my law on their hearts now. So he's breaking this tradition of everything coming through the law, because the law can never perfect us. We can never live up to that. And he says, verse 18, now where there is forgiveness of these things, an offering for sin is no longer required. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let's approach God with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let's hold firmly to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And so this veil that he's talking about, remember that there was a curtain, which they called the veil, that separated the holy place from the most holy place. And the most holy place is where God dwelt over the mercy seat. And so the people couldn't approach. But when Jesus died, the veil tore. It says in Luke 23:44-46, that about the sixth hour, darkness came over the entire land until the ninth hour, because the sun had stopped shining and the veil of the temple was torn in two. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and said, Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit. And then he died. So the day that Jesus died, the veil was torn in two. And this verse in chapter 10 says that his veil was torn through his flesh. And so that no longer separates us from God. Now everyone can approach his throne. And so here in Hebrews 10, it says that we can have confidence to enter the holy place because we have the blood of Jesus, because we've been sprinkled with his blood and washed clean by his sacrifice. Jesus made peace between us and the Father. The thing that separated us, our sin, is now torn like the veil. And so now we can approach God without any fear. All because of Jesus. Now there is peace between us and the Father. Peace in the city of peace. And peace with the world. All that's except him. And so I'm going to end with these two passages. Ephesians 2:14-16 says, he himself is our peace, who made both groups in one, broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the hostility, which is the law composed of the commandments expressed in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two one new person. In this way, establishing peace, that he might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the hostility. And then in Colossians 1:19-22, it says, it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Although you were previously alienated and hostile in attitude, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his body of flesh through death in order to present you before him holy and blameless and above reproach. That's what Jesus did for us, again, giving us his righteousness so we can be seen like that and taking our sin upon himself. So, David was a wonderful king that everyone chose, God included, and Jerusalem was the capital city chosen by God because it was the place that Abraham met with the priest king, and because it's the place that he was willing to offer his son. And so that's all I have for today. Join me next week. And we'll see that David brings the ark to the city of Jerusalem. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss that episode. And then I'll see you back next week. Receive this teaching as a written lesson by email at livethroughjesus.substack.com for $6 a month or $60 a year. With your subscription, you'll also receive access to all the previous lessons, which include the Ten Commandments, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, and Saul. Digital studies are nice because all of the scriptures are linked, so you can just click on them and then read them straight from your device. They're also the cheapest way to do a study with a group because you can just get one subscription and then print out all the materials instead of buying your own book. But if you're satisfied just listening and you don't want to buy the study, you can also become a free subscriber at livethroughjesus.substack.com, and you'll receive a blog post that goes along with each lesson. This is just an application portion of the study, and I also teach it as a devotion on a separate YouTube and podcast channel called Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions. So make sure that you go and subscribe to that too. It's usually a 10 to 15 minute devotion for the week. And then join me on all social media platforms at Live Through Jesus for verses and clips from these teachings.